This is SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.
This episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who is brought to you by the Amazon Store. Click on the link on our website at sqpn.com before you shop at Amazon, and your purchase will help support our show. Welcome to another episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who.
I'm a doctor. I've lived for over 2,000 years.
I am Scottish. I can complain about things.
Shush.
Welcome back to a new episode of The Secrets of Doctor Who, and today we're going to talk about the episode Mummy on the Orient Express. Joining us today, four co-hosts, Stephanie, Father Corey, Jimmy, and Dom. All together, recording this on a Monday, which is officially a feast day, well, a holiday. It's not really a feast day. It's Columbus Day in the United States, isn't it, Jimmy?
Yes, and Columbus is not a saint, so not a feast day.
There you go. At least not for Catholics, but it's a day off for people that work for the government. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's my understanding.
No, since a lot of us are working for the church, no fun for us today.
Well, some of us, some churches get the day off. So,
oh, good.
Excellent. And some of us usually take Mondays as our day off anyways, so.
Exactly.
Yeah, and this is not really work, isn't it? It's just talking about Doctor Who. I mean,
this is fun.
I can't come up with anything more fun than that.
Yeah.
Well, today we're going to talk about a very interesting episode. Visually, there are lots and lots of references in this episode, lots of Easter eggs as well. I am eager to get going with our discussion, but before we do that, let me play the audio from the trailer just to get us in the mood, and then Jimmy, hopefully you'll be able to give us a recap of the events in this episode.
On the next Doctor Who.
There were many trains to take the name Orient Express, but only one in space.
Good morning, everyone. Your goal is to ascertain the foretell's true nature.
I know exactly what this sounds like.
It's immortal, unstoppable, unkillable.
Can we get a new expert?
Those that bear the foretold stare have 66 seconds to live.
Start the clock.
An all-new episode of Doctor Who, Saturday at 9, only on BBC America.
Jimmy, can you take us back to the Intergalactic Orient Express and tell us about the events that happened there?
Sure. So in this episode, the TARDIS appears in a trunk room on the Orient Express train in space, which is kind of ratty, like most trunk rooms. And the Doctor comes out of the TARDIS, and lo and behold, Clara comes out of the TARDIS, which is a bit of a surprise because she broke up with him last episode. But it turns out they're back together. But just as our hopes are rising that everything is better between them, no, it's revealed that this is kind of their goodbye date. And so this is going to be their last hurrah. He's brought her to this swanky train in space. And they're going to be saying goodbye, apparently, at the end of this episode. And neither one of them seems very happy about it. In fact, the Doctor more than once says to her, "I thought this is what you wanted." While they're on the train, a series of killings begin. The killings are apparently committed by a monster that looks like a mummy, but is called the Foretold. And perhaps the reason it's called the Foretold is you've got 66 seconds to live from the time you see the thing. And only certain people, only the victims, can see the thing. It turns out that the train is stocked with researchers, with doctors and professors and scientists, exactly the kind of people who would be useful in studying the mummy. And the Doctor deduces that that's why they're all there. They've all been lured aboard the train by a computer program called Gus that wants them to study the mummy. And when that revelation is made, all of the other hard light hologram passengers vanish, leaving just the researchers and the train staff. Gus tells everybody that he's got a mysterious piece of cloth with symbols on it. And for unknown reasons, the mummy tends to appear near the piece of cloth, but they don't know why. Because the only way to sense the thing is to be one of its victims, they have to wait for people to be killed by the mummy and describe what the mummy looks like and what they're experiencing and things like that. So it's kind of chilling as that happens. The Doctor keeps saying it would be great if he could see the thing because he's such a genius that it wouldn't last a minute with him. And one of the other people says that he doesn't know if the doctor's a genius or just really arrogant. And the doctor says, on a good day, I'm both. The doctor then gets Clara to lie to one of the passengers who is about to be killed and tell the passenger that the doctor can save her, when really he leads Clara to believe he can't. And shockingly, Clara goes along with this lie in order to try to help them solve the mystery and defeat the mummy. So Clara lies to the passenger. And then it turns out the doctor has a way to convince the mummy that he is that passenger. He does a kind of telepathic mind scan thing and assumes that passenger's fears and feelings and thoughts, and that redirects the mummy to him. And while he's having his minute with the mummy, he deduces, based on, for example, symbols that are like those on the flag that are on the body of the mummy, that it's actually a soldier from some long-forgotten war, and it's being kept alive by some tech that's gone haywire and is forcing the mummy to absorb the life energy from other people, hence all of the killings. And there's no more enemy, and the mummy's never been given a stand-down order. And the doctor realizes the piece of cloth the mummy keeps appearing near is actually a flag. And so he surrenders, he gives a surrender message to the mummy, and then he stands the mummy down, at which point the mummy salutes and disintegrates. So the day is saved. Then afterwards, we're back on the TARDIS, and the doctor and Clara are preparing to part. And while that's happening, the doctor is talking to Perkins, who is one of the engineers from the Orient Express, who notes that there's some repair work that needs to be done on the TARDIS and indicates he would be able to do. But when the doctor offers him the role of companion, he refuses. Then Clara gets a call from Danny Pink, who asks if she's told the doctor that, you know, goodbye. And she says, mission accomplished. But then she changes her mind. She decides that she doesn't want to quit her adventuring with the doctor. And so she lies to the doctor about what she and Danny talked about, and tells him they can just keep going. And so the doctor seems excited about that, and we go out on her demanding the doctor show her some new planets.
Very well. Thank you so much for that recap. An episode with quite a few casualties, some guns shooting, and a spectacular mummy that looked just like the ones that we know from the big budget mummy movies. But this time it's in a very small budget television series. Usually around this time I ask you all to give this particular episode a rating, give your general thoughts. I'm going to change things a little bit, and I'm going to ask for your favorite moment in this episode. Stephanie, can I start with you?
Probably my favorite moment of the episode was probably the best thing of the episode for me, was just the look of the episode, of the kind of newer, like 1920s look with the costuming and the jazz singer in the beginning, and just walking through and just being immersed into that environment. I really like that.
What about you, Father Corey? What did you like particularly in this episode?
You kind of threw me for a curveball there.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here trying to think. You know, I can't say there's a particular moment, although I did get kind of a kick out of the engineer, the where he was pretty quick with his lines. Admittedly, I'm kind of a train geek. Among my other geekery, I'm kind of a train geek.
Interesting.
And I really liked the sets. They did such a wonderful job recreating those old style train cars with
Indeed.
All the wood paneling and the gas lamps and electric lamps. But you know, that style of interior of the train was very well done.
You know, I figured that they just used an existing set, that this was just one of those convenient episodes where they're just like lots of the episodes that happen in Victorian England, where they just happen to have a lot of set pieces and dresses and ready for you, so it would be cheap. For this episode, however, they built the entire train from scratch, and they spent weeks on recreating the interior of, or at least an approximation of the interior of the Orient Express, because as the Doctor says, it is slightly bigger than the original train. But they did a terrific job. What about you, Dom?
Well, I would say from this episode, which I like to call Throw the Mummy from the Train, I would say that my favorite, I love the little jokes, especially the inside jokes for the longtime fans. I loved when he says, as he confronts the mummy, "Are you my mummy?"
Yes.
Which is a throwback to that was season one of the reboot episode with a little boy, Jamie, in his gas mask walking around London asking everyone.
Gypsy child.
Yes.
One of the first Stephen Moffat scripts for Doctor Who.
And still, I think, one of the scariest episodes. wasn't it a two-parter?
It was a two-parter. It was really creepy.
Very, very
that
creepy.
That line has come back several times. Yes. You know, with a gas, every time there's a gas mask, someone says it. And I say it around the house all the time to my wife Melanie. So it's one of my favorite lines.
So don't call, don't let the kids call your wife now the mummy.
What I do, I train them to say to walk up and go, "Are you my mummy?
Are you my mummy?" After this episode, it gets a kind of a creepy connotation though. Jimmy, what about you?
Well, I don't know. I haven't had a lot of time to think about a favorite moment, but one that I particularly enjoyed is where the Doctor whips out the psychic paper and tells the conductor, "I am your worst nightmare." And the conductor says, "You're a mystery shopper."
Yes.
And the Doctor says, "What? I'm a mystery shopper.
Is that the best you can come up with?
And I'm very disappointed in your breakfast bar and with all the killings."
Yes.
It kind of confounds them that a mystery shopper would be anyone's worst nightmare.
Exactly. I love the moment visually where the Orient Express, the interior changes into that laboratory version of the train. I thought it was spectacular. I was like, wow, that is amazing. The interior of the train was already amazing. And then having that second set that must have been identical to the other one and then just all, you know, and fancy modern sci-fi look, I thought it was really, really good for just a television series. Just keep in mind, even though, you know, this is a worldwide franchise now, they still work with television budgets and then European television budgets. So I was very impressed by this episode. Jimmy, speaking of the Orient Express, for people that might not know the history of the Orient Express, can you tell us a little bit more about the background of this?
Yeah, so as the name of the Orient Express would tell you, it was a train that ran an express route, which means that it only has limited stops. So whereas most trains stop at every single station, which slows them down, an express train has very few stops, so you get to your destination more quickly. And as the word Orient tells you, it's a train that went from the west to the east. So between 1883 and 2009, just 5 years ago, there was a train route called the Orient Express. It originally ran between Paris, France, and Istanbul, Turkey, but it also had some variations on that route, and it lasted for more than a century, although recently it was retired.
Now, do you know anything about the interior of the Orient Express and whether it was similar to what we see here in the television series? Or,
well, in terms of details, certainly early on it would have been a lot like this because it was a kind of luxury route. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, it was used in a lot of fiction, most notably perhaps in Agatha Christie's Murder on the Orient Express. But it's kind of become a symbol of luxury train travel with mystery and intrigue and so forth. And so it's appeared all over the place, including like in Star Trek The Next Generation. They have an episode that's set in the holodeck on the Orient Express.
Oh, wow. So this wasn't actually the first Orient Express in space. It happened on Star Trek. Well, actually, technically, of course, that is still to happen in the future because it's not in the present. So Doctor Who, I think, formally is the first to...
Well, I don't know. This seems to be a future-oriented episode
me. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we don't know exactly about the time frame.
I haven't been able to book a space train
myself. You're right. There is also a movie called, based on the Agatha Christie novel. I think it's from... Is it in the 70s? 1974. I was 6 years old. And I'm looking at the photos here of that train. And it looks different from what we see in this episode, but stylistically, very much the same. Spectacular.
There's also a movie, it's got Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, called Horror Express or Terror Express.
Ooh.
Only it's going the other way. It's a train crossing Russia heading west with a similar monster on board.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's actually a interesting movie. It also has Telly Savalas playing a Cossack.
Oh, wow. Bald, of course.
Oh, yes.
Well, let's do what we do best here on this show, and that is uncover the secrets of every episode, the hidden gems, the themes, the choices that the characters make. And let's just start with the beginning, when we get introduced to the Doctor and Clara. As you mentioned in your recap, Jimmy, I thought they broke up. What's this with the, you know, our last, what is it, our last dance or our last...
hurrah.
Yeah, last hurrah. What did you all think of that? Stephanie, is this a bit forced, this sudden reconciliation? Or how do you view the relationship between the Doctor and Clara?
I think she cares about him too much to quit. Honestly, I didn't think she was going to actually leave forever in the last episode. She was way too passionate, and Danny kind of told her, you know, if you're so passionate about this, maybe you should think about this more. And she just had to get her anger out and just move on. But I'm not surprised that she came back.
I like the line about the hatred, you know, being... an emotion that you wouldn't spend on or you wouldn't use for people that you care too much about. So the hatred being kind of the flip side of actually really caring about someone. I think that's very true. When people are upset, it's usually about something that they truly care about. Jimmy, what did you want to say?
I don't know. I mean, I could imagine, like, if I was living back in the 1940s, I would have an easier time hating Adolf Hitler than someone I love.
No, I mean, I'm saying it wrong.
Living in the 2000s, I definitely had that for Osama bin Laden more than anybody I love.
No, I think I should say it like this. It's the flip side of finding someone important. It could go both ways. It's something different than being indifferent about someone or someone you really that doesn't matter to you.
That the opposite of love is not hate, it's indifference.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of applies here is that, you know, if when you're passionate, you know, either positively or negatively, those are related. But if you're indifferent, you don't care. And that's more the opposite of that feeling of love. And it's kind of what they're talking about here. If she didn't care, then it would be easier to walk away.
Yeah, the reason that I brought it up is that it's something that's been on my mind quite a bit in the past few years when people have been very upset with Catholics, with the church, with priests, and I've, you know, been in the headlights of many people.
You've been upset at?
Yeah, because I was a representative visually, you know, being a priest and visually recognizable as such, as a representative of a church that a lot of people hated and were very critical about. But I always told myself, you know what? I'd rather have them hate me, because I know it's not personal, but at least it matters to them. I'd rather have people be mad at me or mad at the church than being indifferent. That would be the worst, because then there is no way to enter into a dialogue. Anyway, that's a bit of a side thing here. I love the inside joke of the song. Did you recognize what it was? It was a jazzy version.
It was Don't Stop Me Now by Queen.
Yes. And yeah. I love
it's
that.
It's got a lot of that imagery. That song has a lot of that imagery about, you know, shooting into outer space and things like that.
And, of course, I think the reason that they chose this song was, of course, that right before it, we have that doubt about the relationship between Clara and the Doctor. Is this their last episode? You know, and then you get the "Don't Stop Me Now." I love that. It was almost like our audience feeling that. Don't stop this now. We have to go on with this. And then, of course, it could also refer to the train not stopping. You know.
Oh, okay, sure, that works. By the way, there's I mean, being an express train. Yeah. there's also something that's interesting in that first scene where they're still in the kind of baggage compartment, and they get out of the TARDIS and it's all ratty, and Clara's like, oh, fabulous. And the doctor says, thank you for lying, but it's just the baggage compartment. Yeah. The wonderful is through here. And that lie foreshadows Clara's larger, more significant lie later in the show.
This has been a massive theme in this entire season, right? Lying.
Well, yeah. And she's already willing to lie for the doctor about something trivial to spare his feelings, but then she's going to end up willing to lie for him on a much graver matter that involves somebody's life.
Well, in fact, I would have said that this is a major theme of this episode is lying. You know, that they lie to each other, they lie to everyone else. You know, the doctor lies to the passengers, he lies to Clara, Clara lies to Maisie, she lies to Danny. I mean, this whole thing, they lie and they rationalize. And we'll get to this later, I'm sure, but, you know, this is what addicts do. And that's the other theme of this is addiction. So I would say that the lying is a key element to this whole whole episode.
There's another moment in this first scene where the doctor is struggling with this. It's in his remarks about her smiling and being sad at the same time. Like, that's two emotions and doesn't correspond. It's almost as if you're malfunctioning. Like, you cannot align those two realities. You can smile, and at the same time, the smile itself hides sadness, but it's still visible. And he's like, okay, so what? And then he's like, this is too complicated for me. Can we just talk about planets now? And when he says the truth or utters the truth according to, well, his perspective, it often gets him into trouble because it's hurtful. And sometimes you'd prefer the doctor to lie, to be a little bit kinder instead of just being so harsh with people. So it's almost as if he's a bit like Data in The Next Generation. You know, who doesn't understand the subtleties of human conversation, human social interaction. And he's just blunt, but he's not truly, he doesn't want to be blunt. It's just that he is being logical in a way. Or like Spock, you know, who doesn't understand subtlety.
Or as Dom, I think it was, put it a few episodes ago, he's like an outer space version of Sheldon Cooper.
in one way, I mean, it's highlighting how truly alien he is. He looks like us. He, in fact, in many ways, acts like us. But he's not a human being, and he just has that appearance of it. And this is the most alien of the doctors that we've had.
Yes.
In the new series. Now, I know that, from folks I've seen online talking that maybe Peter Davison's doctor, I think he was the sixth doctor, you know, was also similarly alien and made us uncomfortable. But, you know, I think it's highlighting how, you know, that line near at the end, and I know I'm jumping ahead again, but, you know, where she says, you were pretending to be heartless, she asks him, and he says, would you like to think that about me? And I don't think of that as a cop out, but really as an honest question. Would that make you feel better if you thought if I was pretending to be heartless or what? It's this alienness that really is unsettling, I think, a lot of the viewers about the doctor.
I agree, Dom. The doctor in question that you're thinking of is the sixth one, who is Colin Baker. And I've watched his episodes. He did not last very long as the doctor precisely because his character was written to be unlikable. It wasn't the actor's fault. The actor was fine, but he was required to act in a really problematic way. He was dismissive of the previous doctor and rude to all of the fans of the previous doctor. His first act almost was strangling his companion. And there's a later episode where he like is complicit. He's kind of under the influence of something, but it's not entirely clear. And he seems complicit in a plot to take out the brain of his companion and turn her into a kind of slug-brained creature.
Wow.
And so he just came across as creepy and unlikable at times, but he didn't come across in the kind of really just not getting humanity way that Peter Capaldi does. And so I think that Peter Capaldi, in a way, is a more successful version of Colin Baker's Doctor, because he's written in a way that, even though this is kind of troubling and I still am unsettled about how I feel about Peter Capaldi's Doctor, he's not deliberately mean. He's just very socially awkward and doesn't understand a lot of things about humanity. And that raised a question in my mind about the future, because periodically they have Doctor Who reunions, mm-hmm. where at the big anniversaries where they bring back a bunch of the living doctors or a number of the living doctors and let them play the part again and let them interact. And I was thinking, what is that going to be like 5 years from now or 10 years from now when you have David Tennant and Matt Smith, your good boyfriend doctors, in a special interacting with Peter Capaldi's I Don't Understand Humanity Doctor? And that should be an interesting thing to write and to see in the future.
Yes.
That sounds like it'd be a lot of fun actually to watch.
Yes, indeed. I'm really looking forward to that episode. I keep rooting for Capaldi's Doctor, in a sense that I hope that he's evolving. I hope that he's learning. And the fact that he is, in a way, yes, he is rude, also very funny when he's rude. At the same time, he's kind of like not doing it on purpose. That makes me like him very much. And I'm just entertained by his struggles with our behavior, our human behavior, because he's such a great mirror for us. It's like, yeah, actually, we are kind of weird in the way that we interact, and we're not being honest all the time, and no wonder that he doesn't understand. And that is something, he plays really, really well, I think. And I'm kind of looking at the way that a lot of the fans react to Capaldi, and it seems to me, at least the fans that I'm following, all seem to embrace him more and more with every episode because of his kind of the fine line between awkwardness and but at the same time innocence, and kind of his eagerness to still learn. And I think in this episode there is a bit of a character arc when it comes to his relationship with Clara. You see something is happening. There is something is building there. I don't know exactly what and where they want to take it, but I definitely like him a lot more and find him a lot more interesting and in a way more sympathetic than Denny, for instance, who's just, you know, kind of boring. There's nothing happening. Like, I would have expected the writers to bring in Danny much more into the storylines than they have.
So, you know, yeah, Danny's in danger of becoming another Mickey.
Mm.
Yes. Mm. You know, one aspect of the Doctor's awkwardness I want to kind of highlight here, because we see it in this episode, is the awkwardness, his inability to connect with people around him, often feels like distractedness. When we see the Doctor in this episode and other Doctors, he's often doing something else before or during the time he's interacting with people. So, you know, for example, at the end of this episode, he's writing something furiously in the sand on the beach while Clara is waking up, and we don't know what that is. Or in other times, he's, you know, writing on a chalkboard, and mm-hmm. and he's and his awkwardness and the rudeness is him being distracted and trying to interact with, you know, with the person who's interrupting him while he's doing this thing, and we don't know what that is. What is it he's doing? What is he constantly researching or figuring out? And we get a glimpse into the Doctor's internal processes in that cabin at the beginning, where he's having this full blown argument with himself.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. you know.
One of my questions, you know, who is he talking to? Is he talking to himself? Or he seems to be written very similarly to Sherlock, in, you know, who's also one of Moffat's, you know, creations in a way. And there seems to be the same. But with Sherlock, you have the same problem that he doesn't really want to be rude, but he is, because he seems to be on another plane. He's constantly like already thinking ahead of things. And so you kind of forgive him for being rude.
Well, I have to comment, you know, when he was talking to himself in the cabin, I almost had a glimpse of the Tom Baker Doctor, the fourth Doctor. I mean, just his voice and his personality, just at that moment, that just little flash. But, you know, one thing I've been kind of thinking about, when you see him constantly doing the writing and the kind of often never, never land thinking, is it's part of the foreignness, the alienness of this Doctor, that, you know, I think it's trying to show that his mind operates on a frequency that is so far beyond our level. You know, it's like comparing, if you want to use a computer analogy, a comparison of you know, a modern day, you know, quad core processor versus like an old 1980s era IBM PC. You know, we're the IBM PC and he's the quad core processor.
Or the other way around, he could be, you know, running Windows and we're trying to figure out what the heck he's doing.
Yeah, exactly.
And why the blue screens all the time. let's go back to the train and to what's happening. We were, you know, at the moment of the last hurrah and our fear of, you know, could that be the end of their relationship? The Last Hurrah, by the way, was a title of a 1956 novel by Edwin O'Connor. And in that book, the expression refers to the last moment of glory before a definitive end. So they're definitely implying that this could be the end and this could be their last kind of glory time on the train. However, of course, the Doctor just didn't want to please Clara. It turns out that he actually already knew that there was something going on this train, and apparently he had a phone call even in a previous episode that refers to this.
Yeah, the phone call is in the episode The Big Bang, which was the season closer for the first season of Matt Smith. Mm-hmm. And it's right after the wedding of Rory and Amy, and they get on board the TARDIS, and the Doctor gets a phone call. We don't know from who, but we can, from hearing his side of the conversation, it sounds like there is an Egyptian goddess loose on the Orient Express in space. And he then refers to whoever's calling him as Your Majesty, so someone who's royal. And that apparently, as reinterpreted in this episode, was one of Gus's attempts to lure the Doctor on board the Orient Express. Even though he seemed excited about it at the time, apparently they didn't go.
Yeah.
And so now he's taken Gus up on the offer. Gus was apparently impersonating a royal and lying slightly about what it was. It wasn't an Egyptian goddess. It was this mummy. And so that's an interesting reinterpretation of a scene we've seen before.
Now, what I'm thinking is, of course, this wasn't pre-planned like 4 years ago. It was just a throwaway line that they just used in this episode and expanded on it. But I love that, how they do that. They take something from the past and then use it in the story. There were so many references to earlier episodes, like in the sweets that he offers to the
The
scientist or the professor.
Yeah, he whips out a cigarette case, and in his cigarette case, he's got jelly babies.
Yes,
which were the signature sweet of the fourth Doctor, Tom Baker,
who used it sometimes to get out of trouble and to distract people. But it's so funny that they bring that back here because it's so visually strong. There were also a lot of like real life reoccurrences of people that we've seen in earlier episodes, even vintage episodes. There are a lot of actors that came back for a role in this particular episode. There's Professor Morehouse, is played by Christopher Villiers. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, who was also Hugh Fitzwilliam in the Fifth Doctor adventure, The King's Demons.
Oh, one of the worst ever.
Okay, yeah, so he gets he gets another chance here. I haven't seen that one yet.
He gets a shot at redemption. I like that.
then Janet Henfrey, who plays Mrs. Pitt in this episode, played also Miss Hardiker in a 1989 episode, The Curse of Fenric. And then the guy who plays the mummy, Jamie Hill, has also appeared in a 2013 Doctor Who. It's written here. He appeared as a silent at the Royal Albert Hall in the 2013 Doctor Who prom. Those are the aliens, right? That you don't see, or
right.
you forget them immediately after seeing them. So he's always been a masked character, unfortunately, for him. Although, it's kind of obvious that they want people that are comfortable with wearing latex masks and in this case, bandages.
You mentioned The Curse of Fenric, and there's a similarity between that episode and this one that I saw someone pointing out online. Mm-hmm. In that episode, in order to defeat an ancient monster that has come back to life, the Doctor has to manipulate, and this was the Seventh Doctor. It was whose name I'm blanking on.
Sylvester McCoy.
Sylvester McCoy, right. His companion at the time was a young woman named Ace. And in order to defeat the ancient evil monster, he had to break Ace's faith in him. And so he did some very cruel manipulation of her. And some people have pointed out that that's very similar in a way to what happens in this episode with Clara, the way the doctor manipulates her, and then she has this confrontation with him later about it.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, and the whole idea of the mummy not being a mythical creature that you should be afraid of, but just, you know, approach it from a more scientific point of view. This is just an alien or something like that. It's kind of the same thing. Yeah, in order to win, you have to stick with the facts and not, you know, go overboard with all sorts of beliefs or fears. Although, you know, the doctor volunteering for being the next victim of the mummy, I guess you need to be the doctor for that.
You need to have a strong sense of self-confidence for that.
Yes, which, of course, is the arrogance.
Or the ability to regenerate, true.
That too, yes. Although, as I mentioned before, we still don't really know how many regenerations the Doctor actually has. He's already on, you know, spare time right now.
As many as the show needs.
That's probably the case.
Could I comment about one issue on just the title of this show? Mm-hmm. You know, Doctor Who titles tend to follow certain formulas, and that's even been parodied at times with parodies like The Curse of the Fatal Death and things like that. And in this title follows a formula that was used in a recent season with Matt Smith. Mummy on the Orient Express follows the same title pattern as Dinosaurs on a Spaceship.
Oh yeah.
Which itself was based on the movie title Snakes on a Plane. Mm-hmm. And so when they announced the title of this episode, Mummy on the Orient Express, I thought, oh man, this is going to be so painful because I really hated Dinosaurs on a Spaceship. I thought it was incredibly contrived. And I have to say, this episode was a lot better, and so it exceeded my low expectations.
It sounded like one of those B movies, indeed. It's like, oh, it's going to be one of those throwaway period pieces where they just, you know, again, they just use existing props to do like an in-between episode. But fortunately, it went way far further than that. This is not the first time that the Doctor encounters a mummy or other mythical creatures. And there's a nice little recap of all the occurrences of mythological monsters in the Doctor Who archives on the BBC website in their weekly Doctor Who Extra episodes. And I'd like to play that here for a second so it saves us some time.
Spooky stuff. But this isn't the first time the Doctor has faced an enemy that resembles a monster from our own planet's myths and legends. During a visit to the Torchwood estate, the Doctor was hounded by what looked to be a werewolf, but turned out to be a lupine wavelength Haemoveriform. Probably easy to call it a werewolf. And there were more fangs in 16th century Europe, when the 11th Doctor faced the so-called Vampires of Venice. These bitey beauties were Saturninians, and he found out they used perception filters to mask their true appearance. In fact, the Doctor has uncovered many myths about, well, mythology. He discovered that at least some of the legendary Yeti, or abominable snowmen, were machines controlled by the Great Intelligence, and the Loch Ness Monster is actually a creature brought to our world by the Zygons. The Nymon didn't bother with any disguises and closely resembled the Minotaur from Greek mythology. The 11th Doctor also had a run-in with a Minotaur-type creature.
So there you have it. Lots of mythological creatures actually turning out to be aliens. And there being a more scientific explanation, or sci-fi scientific explanation for their existence, than the human mythology came up with.
Kind of a sci-fi version of Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, in a way, it's that same. It's not really a ghost. It's just this guy that we've already seen in the episode, and he's hiding who he truly is. That, of course, is a big question for me when it comes to the overall story arc in this season with the afterlife, you know, heaven, the hereafter. all religious terms, and will this season go that same route? Will it also explain away, in a certain way, the human beliefs in a life after death?
I think it's going to toy with that idea, but I don't think it's going to give us a definitive statement in favor of atheism.
Mm-hmm. It's something that I hear a lot among, you know, Catholics talking about Doctor Who, and it's like, oh, that show is so anti-Christian, so atheist in its writing. I don't know if that's true, or whether that is just kind of part of the whole narrative of Doctor Who, where it is science fiction. So, you know, it doesn't pretend to be a show that just wants to explain away things. But on the other hand, I don't know many examples of faith playing a very kind of open role in the Doctor Who history. Now, of course, I haven't seen every episode, but what do you think, Jimmy? You've probably seen the most episodes of all five of us.
I think that Doctor Who is part of British culture in a way that is not, at this point, publicly, openly embracing faith, but also is not totally excluding it either. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the attitude towards religion has been somewhat, I mean, it's not an overtly Christian show or anything. It's never been that.
No.
But it has entertained elements of religion, including Christianity, in interesting ways. The 10th Doctor, for example, mentions that he was at the first Christmas. Hmm. And does so without casting any scorn on the idea. The Doctor has met the devil. And talked about it as, yeah, I met the devil afterwards. So it is open but not endorsing, I would say, to mm-hmm. these ideas. And you also have the flip side. You also have various dethronements of religious ideas at various points. And I think the show maintains a deliberately unsettled mm-hmm. attitude toward such things. And I think that's a good thing for it if it wants to achieve its purpose as a secular BBC show appealing to a broad global audience. Because if it became just a kind of a covert evangelization mm-hmm. mechanism or an overt evangelization mechanism, it would diminish its support. And if it gave a definitive no to mm-hmm. the religious, it would also diminish its support. So in a way, like a lot of TV shows, it takes a deliberately ambiguous attitude to avoid offending sections of people in the audience that it wants to keep watching.
Well, and isn't that also the function of classic sci-fi? It's being a mirror of what happens in society, and society is made up out of atheists and religious people, and there is a whole diversity, and you try to reflect that in your stories so they become believable.
Well, some science fiction is that way, but there's also science fiction that is explicitly religious. Mm-hmm. If you look, for example, at some of the Ender books by Orson Scott Card, mm-hmm. religion is a very prominent theme in those, and there are others as well.
I mean,
those
are probably C.S. Lewis with his science fiction
space trilogy.
Star Trek: Deep Space Nine had religion as a prominent aspect of it.
Yes.
The reboot of Battlestar Galactica had religion as a prominent mm-hmm. aspect
and,
of it.
And even Babylon 5, even though that entire series was conceived and written by Straczynski, he's a well-known atheist, had a lot of religious themes and done very, very well.
Yeah. So it was very
fascinating.
It's funny how respectful he really was towards religion when he himself has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
In fact, in one of the last things that's been produced in the Babylon 5 universe, the Lost Tales DVD, there's an actual exorcism that is performed on Babylon 5.
Wow!
And so they bring in a priest. There's a guy who's possessed by a demon, and the demon wants to be exorcised so it can escape from captivity that it had been in on Earth.
Amazing. Well, let's go back to the exorcism that needs to take place on the Orient Express, because in a way, it's kind of what that seems to be. The mummy is being held captive by the spirit of his past, you know, having been a soldier, and then the doctor almost acting like a priest who is exorcising the mummy, or at least relieving him from his ongoing duties. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but Jimmy, I remember a couple of episodes ago we talked about the doctor, you know, with his muddled relationship with soldiers, and then right. at one point there was a moment where actually the doctor seems to be very much in the military and even above soldiers.
Right. That's something that's in the episode The Caretaker. And in that episode, the doctor meets Danny Pink and has a very bad reaction to Danny as a soldier. But Danny then busts the doctor and declares him to be actually an officer. And then in that episode, the climax, and we didn't point this out at the time, but the climax hinges on the doctor pretending to be an officer and telling the shooty crab thing to stand down. Mm-hmm. And we get something basic. Well, we get basically the same thing in this episode. In this episode, the doctor, interestingly enough, is willing to send people to their deaths in order to achieve the goal, which is very soldier officer like thinking. And then at the end of it, once he deduces what the mummy is, he then gives a surrender, and then he gives the mummy a stand down order again, acting in place of someone higher than the mummy in the mummy's chain of command. So he again assumes the role of a soldier, even the whole time he's been decrying soldiers.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it's something that they will expand upon in the future? Are we going to learn something about the doctor? Or is this just referring to his past, you know, being involved in the whole wars?
Units and then the yeah. Time War mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see. I would like to see them deal with this. I'd like to find them kind of – because so far he's just been a jerk mm-hmm. towards all soldier kind. And I hope that he's going to come to some kind of resolution where he realizes there is a role for the military, because there is. I mean, any society that doesn't defend itself is going to be destroyed by outsiders. So – There is a legitimate role for defense, and I hope that we get to a point where the doctor is not acting like a knee-jerk pacifist and not recognizing that fact all mm-hmm. the time.
It's one of the interesting themes in this episode. Another thing that struck me towards the end of the episode, where they go back to the whole relationship between the doctor and Clara, it strikes me that in several episodes now, a number of the elements that we see of the story seem to be a reflection or almost like an analogy to the themes in the relationship between the doctor and Clara. And remember the conversation between Clara and that was it the granddaughter of the old lady who dies in the beginning?
Yeah.
And apparently she has struggled with the nasty character of her grandmother. And then Clara is, you know what? Sometimes people do that to you. Or says something like obnoxious people can bring up all those, can make you feel all sorts of things, clearly referring to her relationship with the doctor. And then that whole countdown, you know, to 66 seconds, counting down. It's almost over, the doctor tells, you know, the victims. It seems to me that that is also referring to the kind of the clock ticking on his relationship with Clara, and that also might be almost over, and this might be the final countdown. And I like that they do that. It makes me care more. It makes the stories less of just a throwaway story, but there's also kind of a meta layer in it that has to do with that relationship that is changing and evolving.
There was definitely the realization on Clara's part that when it's over, it's over. When she talks about, we could stop by for dinner unless you don't do that because you find it boring, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of that realization that once she leaves the TARDIS for good, it's for good. You know, she'll never see him again. You kind of saw a little of that with Matt Smith's doctor, where he kept popping in on Rory and Amy, but it wasn't sticking around. It was taking them off somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, there's another clock ticking in all this too, which is, you know, Clara at the end lied to the doctor about Danny saying it's okay for her to go. And she lied to Danny about breaking off with the doctor. And so, you know, in a way, the clock is ticking there.
Yes.
That there's a, to excuse the metaphor, a train wreck coming. but when one or both, probably both, figure this out at some point, and it's going to cause a serious problem. I mean, this is you know, Clara keeps, she keeps diving back into this. She keeps creating these more and more of these problems because she's an addict. She can't let go. She wants to have it both ways. She wants to have the stay-at-home life with Danny, but she also wants the life of adventure with the doctor, and she can't break it off with either one, and she wants to have it both ways.
And is she addicted to the doctor, or is she addicted to the thrill of all those adventures? The same question that she probably has about the doctor. Does he care about her, or does he only care about her in the sense that she might be useful to, you know, provide him with some company during all those adventures? Is that why the doctor at the end seems to hint at, you know, getting another companion? For a moment, I was like, oh my gosh, he's going to hire the mechanic on the train.
Yeah, and that's not the first time. I mean, we had the same thing with Courtney Woods, and yep. I think even someone else this season. One thing that struck. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. The couple from the heist. I forget the character.
Right. Yeah. Name.
But the doctor does seem to be acquiring potential future companions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing that struck me about Perkins, the engineer, is he's actually from the future and has traveled the stars, and so I could see why it would be less attractive for him to become a companion of someone who travels in space and time, if he's already has access to the broader universe. And that made me think, the doctor hasn't had he's had a few companions from the future, but usually the recent future. Mm-hmm. So like one of the second doctor's companions, Zoe, was from the late 21st century. So that's not very far in the future. You could see why the doctor keeps going back to pre-space exploration times to find his companions, because they're going to be the ones most excited about experiencing the universe.
It's more fun. And he can be the genius doctor. And there seems to be some pleasure in it. And it was funny to see that actually this mechanic is probably the second smartest man on the train and knows a lot and is taken seriously by the doctor. Mm-hmm. It was a personal drama, though, for the actor, Frank Skinner, who plays Perkins. He's a well-known comedian in the UK. Especially to play that scene with the doctor, and then the doctor actually inquiring whether he would join the doctor on a more permanent base, and then he had to say no. Because Frank Skinner apparently is one of the biggest Doctor Who fans in the UK. he's a massive, massive fan. He's got a TARDIS ringtone on his cell phone. He's got a 5-foot cardboard Dalek in his sleeping room, in his bedroom. And when he got the call that they wanted him to read for the part, he was in a tour bus watching episode 3 of the Sensorites. So, massive fan, and then having to say no, it's just for this time, was very painful for him.
You know, I have to admit, when as that character developed, I almost wondered if it was going to be one of those twists where he had something to do with it.
Yeah, he's
one of those characters that he was right there. He knew everything that was going on. He was right in the middle of it all, and it's just like, is this going to be one of these twists where it turns out that this guy is an employee of whoever it is that set all this up?
Yeah. Who did set this up, though? Who is Gus?
Someone with the doctor's phone number, which very few people in the universe have, which also connects us over to the fact that Clara was given the doctor's phone number by somebody.
And doesn't Missy also have the phone number?
We're heading towards Missy, so Gus may be Missy's version of Siri or something.
Yeah. Interesting, because it did seem to be a computer voice. So, yeah, it could be Missy.
Well, they kept calling it a computer, and I think it was pretty clear that, yes, it was just the computer on the train that was programmed that way.
But, well, right. On the train, whenever they would refer to it as computer, it kept saying, call me Gus.
Yeah.
And that seemed odd to me. I don't know if it was trying to play the period part of we're in the Orient Express in the early 20th century, or maybe there's something more there. Maybe he really, you know, wasn't just a computer program. Maybe there's something more to that. I don't have any specifics, you know, on what it could be, but you know, it seemed quite odd to me that he kept saying that, and there was this I don't know, this something struck me as odd about how it kept insisting not to address me as a computer.
Yeah.
The name, I took that as comedy, as, you know, just kind of clueless programming on the part of its programmers wanting people to interact with it as a person when everyone is only interacting with it as a machine. It's kind of like if you went up to a bank teller, you know, to an ATM machine, mm-hmm. just to withdraw your money, and it says, "Hi, please call me Gus." You know, it's like, I don't care about that. I just want my mm-hmm. money. I just want this door open.
Mm-hmm. Gus comes from Augustine.
Augustus
means majestic. I'm not sure if there's anything more to that. I'm always triggered by names. I was like, okay, is there a deeper meaning to that? But I can't find it in yet. It
could also be an acronym for something too, which would
be good point. Yes. I was surprised that we didn't get a redemption scene for the mummy. We've seen a mm-hmm. lot of the people dying, like showing up in Missy's presence and getting another chance at eternal life. And with the mummy, you kind of almost pity him at the end of the episode. It's just a soldier who couldn't stop and, you know, just had to be redeemed in a way by the doctor or delivered. So you actually, is it because he's saved?
It would be interesting to see a scene like that, but imagine how that would go. I mean, we've never seen the mummy as in its pre-decayed form.
That's true.
And everyone else who's died has showed up in their final form. So we'd have the mummy there in the nether sphere with someone introducing it to the afterlife, and the mummy is like, I mean, how would that play?
You know,
perhaps.
With the body count in this episode, I was nearly certain we were going to have another appearance of Missy in the Nethersphere, and I'm actually surprised that we didn't get anybody showing up there. So I'm curious now why that is.
Well, it's possible too that they could purposely be holding that off for whenever the big reveal of whatever the Nethersphere is, when the Doctor ends up there, and we see all these people. Because I have a feeling it's going to be played off. All these people who end up there are going to be played off where somehow, some way, in the episode when the Doctor is finally facing Missy, mm-hmm. that they'll be in the background or they'll come up to the Doctor or something like that.
Well, and I think one of our previous theories was that only people show up with Missy that couldn't be saved by the Doctor. In this episode, even though there are some casualties, of course, and we've got the entire culinary crew being ejected in space, it's not truly the Doctor's fault, and he is saving the mummy.
A lot of train food, I can sympathize with that. That's just a joke.
Now, do we think that the Doctor lied to Clara about saving everyone? At the very end, where he told her, "Oh yes, we got everybody off, and they're all over that city over there," do we think he did actually accomplish that?
No, I think he did.
Yeah, and the reason is because he saved Perkins, and until they showed us Perkins, I was entertaining the question as well. Mm-hmm. But he clearly got people besides Clara off
mm-hmm.
of the train before it blew up.
But I think it was very interesting that he admitted that it was almost by accident, and that if he wouldn't have been able to save the last victim, then he would just have gone on. And so it's really the question of, is he truly a redeemer, or is it just someone who just calculates and tries to figure out the solution to a problem, to an enigma?
Well, that's where I think you can see the parallels with Sherlock, because it's the same kind of thing, where mm-hmm. it's all about solving the puzzle, solving the riddle, you know. What's the answer to the formula?
Yeah, it comes back to that same question over and over again. Is the Doctor a good man? And he seems to be. He doesn't know himself. He's like, I'm uncertain about that. Did I really save these people?
Yeah, and that's different from previous Doctors who have had a much clearer sense of we need to do the right thing.
Yeah. Stephanie, what do you think? Is the Doctor a good man, or is it just by accident that he's helping all these people?
I think he is, but at this incarnation, I'm not sure. Previous ones, I definitely would have an answer, but I'm not sure.
It's
kind of ambiguous, just like he is.
He says, to Clara, you know, I'm the man who has to make an impossible choice from time to time. Like, no matter what you choose, it's always going to end badly. So he seems to be the victim of fate, almost.
You know, I'd like to make a point about that, because that is the opposite of what happens in the Kill the Moon. You know, he says, I'm always the one who has to make the impossible choice, except he didn't make the impossible choice in that episode,
indeed,
which is what caused Clara to be so upset at him. He made her make the impossible choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's the impossible girl.
She asks him, do you love being the man who makes the impossible choice? So I'm wondering, you know, is this him redeeming himself in her eyes for being the one to do that?
Interesting. By the way, his thing with Clara, forcing her to make the impossible choice, kind of echoes an episode with the previous Doctor where he forced Rory to make an impossible choice, and Rory pushed back, saying, you're trying to make me like you. Mm-hmm. That was the girl who waited, where a version of Amy had become incredibly aged.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes, I remember that one.
You know, thought too is on this, you know, this whole topic of the good man, is the Doctor a good man? It really, at least in my mind, it brings up the question too of what does that mean to say someone's a good man? Because, you know, we might say that someone we know is a good man because he's fun to be around, he's enjoyable, he generally will, you know, reach out to people, and, you know, he won't do anything to intentionally harm anyone. And we'll say, oh, he's a good man because, you know, we like being around him, we like having fun with him. But you might also say someone is a good man who makes the tough decisions, who does what needs to be done, even if it means that someone is going to get hurt,
mm-hmm.
that he's willing to take on the risks to do what needs to be done. And you would say that's a good man, you know, because he does, you know, a good soldier is one that's willing to take the risks at his expense and, you know, if necessary, at the risks of his companions to do what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Or a good doctor is one who's willing to cause pain for the patient in order to heal them.
Yeah.
Exactly.
By the way, which reminds me, in this episode, finally the question is asked, what are you a doctor of? And the doctor is like, yeah, I wish that people would ask this more often. His answer here is, I am a doctor of intestinal
parasites.
Parasites. Probably referring to the mummy inside the train or something like that.
Well, he's used that. He's been asked that many times throughout the series, and he always comes up with a different answer. You know, sometimes it's like a doctor of everything, a doctor of nothing. You know,
or he'll at least deflect, because people often assume he's a medical doctor.
Yes,
and like there in an early Tom Baker episode, he was asked if he's a medical doctor, and he says, "No, my title is for other things." But he begged off the medical doctor, although. On more than one occasion, it's been said on the show that he actually had medical training, if I recall from Lister, the physician who discovered antisepsis. And so he, at least when the show needs it, does have medical skills.
Well, you know what? I've always thought if he can time travel, he could be good at anything, because he could just go back in time and ask Chopin to teach him to play the piano. I mean, it could be like in Groundhog Day, you know? You just keep going back in time and just learn whatever you need. And, you know, you wouldn't lose a second by doing that. There was another small detail that struck me at the end of the episode for the first time, and that is when Clara is in the TARDIS again and makes that phone call with Denny, lying to him, lying to the doctor afterwards. Did y'all notice that ringtone? That's actually not a ringtone you hear very often on a regular cell phone. It has a very particular sound, and it did literally ring a bell all of a sudden. I was like, that is the exact same ringtone as the one that is used in The Matrix. When there are, you know, calls between the virtual realm and the real world. Mm. And I'm thinking that must be on purpose, because every time that phone rings, it is, you know, Clara being either on a train or in the TARDIS or in some alternate universe calling the real world, which is Danny Pink. And I thought just the brilliant that they used that Matrix ringtone for that, almost as a reminder that, you know, she is living in two different worlds, in two different realities. And she clearly likes to be in the Doctor's Matrix. She's addicted to it, just like the characters in the Matrix. Some of them want to stay inside the Matrix because it's so much more fun than the real world. And the virtual steak tastes so much better than the drab, you know, porridge that you have to eat. And there's one final thing we need to start wrapping up. Did y'all catch the massive, massive symbolism of that last scene?
Which massive symbolism was this?
Well, this is might be just a theory, but I'm like, okay, the Doctor just saved the mummy, right? He is proving again that he is a savior, a redeemer. You could even say he's performed an exorcism. You know, he's delivered this soldier from his fate. And the next scene, once they escape from the train, is on a beach. And what is he doing? He's using a stick to write in the sand. And then what is in the foreground? A fire. I was like, that's so similar to the stories of the first encounter after the resurrection between the apostles and Jesus on the beach. I'm thinking this must be deliberate. This must be a way to kind of like almost subconsciously tell us, savior figure, you know, archetype, redeemer.
And in the Gospel of John, they have that huge futuristic city in the background.
Exactly. Which for some reason never shows up in the readings at church. It's so disappointing. The coolest things.
No, but I did notice that the writing in the sand. Of course, that was my immediate thought, was the story of the woman caught in adultery, where Jesus is writing in the dirt. I kind of missed the part about, I guess it kind of went over my head, the beach and the fire and everything. And you mentioned it.
There's no reason for that fire to be there. And so I was like, this is kind of like
keeping Clara warm.
Well, she's very far away from that fire.
He's a doctor. He's
dramatic.
He could
have transported her to a time of the day where it's, you know, a slightly warmer. But I was thinking, okay, that they're trying to convey that the thing, you know, with the religious theme of the afterlife and heaven and his question, am I truly a good man? Am I a redeemer or not? Am I just addicted to adventure or not? I'm thinking these are the meta themes that they're trying to highlight. But again, yeah, it might just be a wild theory of a priest who sees too many things.
My personal suspicion is, I mean, you want to retreat to a natural, safe-seeming location after all that, and you also want to save money after you've blown it all on special effects and rebuilding a big train set. So going to the beach is an attractive option.
Could be. I'd love to ask the writers if they did this on purpose or not. Well, that wraps it up for this episode of The Secrets of Once Upon a Time. That's my. I'm doing too many podcasts. That's my other show. It's called
Stuck in Time, Father Roderick.
Secrets of Once Upon a Time. That's also on SQPN, but it's about a totally different TV series. My apologies. Let me play the sound of the trailer for the episode of next week, which is called Flatline.
Oh, that can't be good.
Something nearby is leeching all the external dimensions.
Aliens.
Possibly. Oh, who am I kidding? Probably. Whatever they are, they're an experiment. They're testing. They are dissecting. Trying to understand us. Trying to understand three dimensions. Life support failing.
I already love it. Flatline, referring to probably aliens that don't know how 3D works and are messing up our universe. I love that. Even from a philosophical point of view, there's always been fascinating, you know, the whole thing about imagine a world where there's just two dimensions. next time we'll be back, of course. But before I say goodbye, let me do the rounds again. Stephanie, where can people find you on the web?
You can find me on Twitter, Angel Steph, AngelSTEPH, or you can find my podcast at TVRewindPodcast.com.
What are you talking currently about on TV Rewind? Which shows are, you know, the main shows?
Well, I've kind of reviewed the pilots that I liked the most and avoided the other ones that I knew were going to be bad. Mm-hmm. So that's basically just going through the premieres.
Which one is your favorite right now?
The Flash. I just watched that.
Oh, yeah. I watched it yesterday. I loved it too.
Reviewed it on my last episode. So
surprisingly,
check it out.
It felt like a Spider-Man movie almost.
It was fun.
Very, very fun. Dom, where can people find you?
You can find me at my website, betnet.com, BETTNET.com, and on the Secrets of Star Wars, where we're getting into some really good spoilerish rumors on the new Episode 7 movie.
It's almost hard to keep up. Since our last episode, what was it, Friday that we recorded it? The new spoilers already. Yeah, big ones. So if you're into Star Wars, you might want to check that out as well. Jimmy, where can people find you?
They can find me at letswatchdoctorwho.com and at jimmyakin.com.
And finally, Father Corey.
You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Google+, even the new Elio at Fr. Corey Sticha, last name spelled Sticha. And I'm also a regular panelist on SQPN's Catholic Weekend.
You're almost like a doctor. You're everywhere. Showing up everywhere. I'm Father Roderick. You can find me on sqpn.com, which is the website of the StarQuest Production Network, where you will find links to all our shows and podcast series. There are quite a few that you might like if you like this show. Thank you for listening. If you have some time, leave us a review on iTunes, and hopefully we'll see you back for the next episode of Secrets of Doctor Who.
Will I see you again?
Soon, I expect. Or later. One of those.